If you look at my background, it's like, you're an engineer, you're obsessed with problems. Like, how can I get this to run in 30 milliseconds? Like optimizing that sort of thing. And then you realize, whoa, if this runs in 30 milliseconds, but the humans using it take 20 minutes to figure it out, like you may not have solved for the bigger problem. And so you get into design, great product. And then all of a sudden you realize, okay, if I do good design and good engineering work, I can build a great product. But if it's not wrapped in a great business, you never get to do the 2.0 and the 3.0, right? And that sort of thing. And so there's layers to the problem.
Welcome back for part two of our unsolicited feedback episode with Adam Nash, CEO of Daffy Giving. Adam is an expert on all things fintech. He's been a builder and tinkerer in the space for quite a while. And so we dive into the challenges facing consumer fintech over the coming years. And we do a little bit of analysis of what the big companies are doing, what your competitors are doing. And he uses some, I think, counterintuitive views on Clayton Christensen's disruption theory that I think are worth listening to. We'll jump right in.
Do you have any predictions on how the development process might change with AI?
AI is such a big platform shift. I'm very bullish in general about the current wave of AI technology, et cetera, just because I do believe that the fundamental driver for the industry tends to be one of two things. On the one hand, technology gives us the gift. Every half a decade, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, we find ways to take things that were just very expensive and difficult and make them easy and very inexpensive. Right. And so that just opens up a whole set of opportunities. That, by the way, that's not just true in software. It's just very rare outside software that you get this magical gift all the time. Effectively, SpaceX is doing this with rocket launches, right? Where if you radically drive down the price of doing a launch, all these new ideas become possible because you're like, if it only costs that much to do it, then this becomes economically viable. And then the other innovation is on the distribution side. I still go back fundamentally, like, why was mobile so big? Let's be clear, it's because we went from 1 in 10 people having a computer that they use regularly for a few hours a day, and we went to a device that everyone has and they keep in their pocket 24 hours a day. And so that's almost two orders of magnitude growth.
Yeah.
And so that just opens up a lot. When I look at AI, I see that first innovation where, wow, there's just so many problems that I can think of in my own career that I had to work on at different times that were so difficult. I remember when OCR was difficult, right? The accuracy of scanning text. Even when we were there, Joff, even 10, 12 years ago, what was Card Munch? It was another solution using Mechanical Turk to figure out how to transcribe business cards. And so I just look at AI right now and I see this amazing opportunity. If you're new, you're a new product manager, your early career, you're an early engineer, designer. Wow, like you now have superpowers, right? Like you're a designer. I had one venture capitalist tell me on one of their portfolio companies that one designer on their team using Stable Diffusion, a few other tools, was able to do a brand exploration in a couple days that they normally would have taken 4 weeks to do.
Right.
Right. Yeah. As an engineer, I talked about newsgroups, Stack Overflow. Compare that to Copilot or, you know, the number of the other tools you have. That's amazing. I feel like if I sat down as rusty as I am right now to write a new app for the iPhone or that sort of thing. And then, of course, on features and products innovation, right? There's so many things that you couldn't do before that you now can. That being said, that's always the flaw with these technologies is you get this heavy move of it becomes a brand by itself for fundraising, et cetera. It leaks through the investment community to the founders, to the teams. And you start getting a little bit like AI for AI's sake.
You talked a little bit about the distribution piece, which I think is really interesting, is that the last couple of consumer waves were driven by distribution changes. Facebook ads made D2C possible and mobile app distribution possible. Virality and those types of tactics made social gaming possible, Web 2.0 possible, social products. But one thing I'm questioning right now is that distribution's actually gotten fundamentally harder. And we have more and more capabilities for consumer products and even business products. But as far as I can tell, no new distribution opportunities that are coming out of these that are going to make the growth that you need possible beyond word of mouth. This is really cool. Let me talk about it with my friends. But as we all know, there are ceilings to that. So as you look at this, do you think the distribution challenges are alleviated at all? Or do you think we're just pouring lots and lots of money into things that can't grow?
Well, we're definitely doing some of that last point.
Yeah.
But we always do.
Worse
we
than
always
ever.
Do, right? Like, let's be clear, like Web 1.0, if you invested in every Web 1.0 company, economically, you did great. You have some multi-trillion dollar winners in there. You have all this other stuff. But let's be also, most of it went away or got fused into other things. I even joke, obviously, LinkedIn, we effectively destroyed one of the Web 1.0 winners. Like, where's Monster? Like, what happened to that? I remember how big Monster.com was at the time and how people thought you couldn't enter it. But yeah, distribution, I think this is important. This is why you see folks, obviously, this is why you see so much effort on the next device. Is it going to be Internet of Things? That would multiply the number of devices by 10x, 100x. That's why there was excitement there. Maybe everything's a computer now. And so maybe we go from everyone having one phone to having almost a constellation of devices. And that's an opportunity, distribution opening. I think that obviously VR, AR is this other kind of new devices, new UI means new ways to solve old problems. And so you get some distribution advantage there. By the way, I don't think it's quite that dark. It's easy to feel that way in the industry. I feel it right now. Like even in recent memory, Acorns has millions of paying customers on this app to help people save and invest, make their financial lives better. But it grew off mobile app distribution, and the tussle between Apple and Facebook on this basically eviscerated that channel economically for so many. Everyone arguing about that, I was really shocked at how many people just didn't see underneath and said, no matter how you feel, like everyone's talking about this data thing, Apple, Facebook, everyone has their teams. I was like, no, like you're literally killing one of the paths out that enables so many small businesses, so many startups to give life.
So I think it's a huge piece of the stagnation in the mobile app rankings. If you don't have proprietary data, you can't grow. It's really hard.
But the influencer thing is actually big. I think there are channels now. Look, I don't think Mr. Beast and the other things are a fluke. I think there's a lot of commonality between distribution and the consumer market. We can focus on apps and services, but really like building brands, awareness. I think that's still possible and you're still seeing it get done. And by the way, in terms of formation, I don't want to be too dark. If you take the valuation pieces out of it, of we had these crazy multiples come in and uneconomic stuff happening through the pandemic, in terms of the number of really high quality companies and products and new services, I would argue that we're still seeing an acceleration, largely because the gift that keeps on giving is that the consumer market moves in terms of what they're willing to accept, right? And the trend that hasn't stopped yet is that more and more businesses on the enterprise or B2B side and more individuals still seem willing to try more new things and trust more of their lives to software services, right? Look at my current thing, Daffy. It's amazing to me. And Daffy is very young, so it's brand new, right? We've only been live a little over 2 years. What's our minimum donation? It was $20 when we launched. I got yelled at by a couple of customers. We lowered it to 18. Mistakes. Everyone makes mistakes. We even lowered it to 10 for the campaigns feature we just launched. But I just approved this week two donations that are over $1 million. We had over 105 million in contributions last year. The idea that we have gone to a point in the consumer market where people implicitly trust online services. They don't just trust them with money, but they trust them with hundreds of millions of dollars, in some cases, billions of dollars. Wellfront now just announced this week that they have, I think, I don't want to give away numbers I'm not supposed to, but I think they over 50 billion in managed by this company. Yeah. I cannot tell you in the early days of Wellfront how skeptical people were that anyone would trust a computer to manage any significant amount of money. And now you have a service that's scaled to more than 500,000 clients and then $50 billion. This is an amazing thing. So I do think that there are opportunities, but I agree with you. Platform shifts from a distribution standpoint are such a big open window. Whatever you think of where the iPad is today, and everyone has a point of view on where devices are going and platforms, but there were companies that were born because the iPad was launched, and that opened up like, oh, what can we do with this tablet and what apps are for this device? This is true with every wave of technology. This is the most exciting thing because maybe AI does change the game. Maybe some of the old things that failed before are possible, right? I keep looking at things like AirPods and going, wait, that's a little bit of ambient computing going on, right? A lot of people spend a huge portion of the day with these little, and by the way, those aren't just earphones anymore. Those have chips, they have computers, they have awareness, they're pulling in the functionality. It could be that like we just keep working the problem and we haven't had that breakthrough yet, but you saw what happened with AI. We're working on it. It felt like it's always 30 years away. And then all of a sudden it's not. And I feel like we might feel that way about devices too. Some of the ideas the last 10, 15 years, we might be surprised in the next 10 years that some of those things open up. We were just early.
I want to come back to Daffy for a second because you've always loved finance. If you had like a I don't know if it's your first love or your second love, but I remember post IPO at LinkedIn, I think you set up almost like a workshop to explain to people how finance works and how to think about their new wealth. And then of course you went on to Wealthfront and now you've got this new thing, Daffy. Maybe you can do two things. What's so compelling about finance for you? And then, because you've touched on Daffy, but you haven't backed up and told people, like, what is it? Because some of the listeners won't know Daffy the way that Fried and I do.
Yeah, no, finance was actually not something that was an early love for me. When I look back, there's a little bit of the entrepreneurship stuff, like my brother and I picking lemons off the tree and going door-to-door selling them in the neighborhood, like 10 cents each or three for a quarter, that sort of thing. But no, I came into personal finance in college. And actually, it was a product, once again, of my own experience. And I tell this story a lot that my first software internship was actually my sophomore year. And I ended up working at Hewlett Packard. And I remember sitting down for that interview. And the guy was like looking for an intern. My advisor had recommended me. And they said the internship pays $2,235. I was like, okay, that's less than I made last summer. But this is a good experience. Hewlett Packard's a great company. And then he said a month. And this literally was like more money than I'd ever.
Yeah.
And so I made $6,000 that summer, which was just an amazing amount of money. My previous job, I had done some research that played a grant of a few thousand dollars, but I was at the Stanford bookstore fixing computers and selling them for $6.25 an hour. So I thought it was amazing. And so I made $6,000. And then by Thanksgiving of that year, I had spent most of it, mostly on a Quadra 800, which really was an amazing computer, and a 14-inch monitor, I think.
Well worth it.
Gave me the space to work. But no, I was just horrified. And fortunately, my grandmother, who was a teacher, had recently retired. And so she spent a lot of time on this. She was in the mutual fund. She had those big books. Like back then, like no web, right? Like it was all distributed like in paper and you'd get these giant binders of information about mutual funds and stuff. But she taught me about what a certificate of deposit was and what a bond was and a mutual fund. And that started this journey. Fortunately, I was in school, so I kept learning. And yeah, you're right. My senior project at Stanford, computer science, you have to do a senior project. I was trying to build a better Quicken. I was convinced that better way to manage investments. And I have always loved it. And it has been a rewarding thing for me personally. Every company I've gone to, I've just been underwhelmed and borderline upset with how little information employees were given to make pretty important financial decisions. And so I did what I could as I became a manager, a director, a VP. Believe me, HR didn't always love, because they were always risk averse. What if you give financial advice that someone doesn't and sues the company?
Did you have to do like a 2-minute disclaimer before your talk?
Now I do. It turns out once you've worked for an SEC regulated company, you put disclaimers on everything, disclosures and stuff. No, but I would always ask, like, when has this ever happened? Like, where are these lawsuits? There's a weird risk aversion to these things, but it's a personal passion. I mean, I've been teaching now at Stanford, personal finance for engineers. 7 years. It's become a very popular course. And I've opened up the course material. And every year I get a handful of professors and teachers, sometimes at colleges and universities, sometimes at high schools and junior high schools, who want to bring personal finance education in. And they say, can I use your content? And I'm like, please do. Like, I really think everyone should be educated. But I do think we map our passions. I think we're always at our best as product leaders in particular, when we authentically care about a problem and a market. And we empathize and understand the customer problem and the user. It's always easier to really go deep. I think people who love video games do a better job 100%. Doing video games. I think people who love movies do a better job making movies. And so personal finance is one of the things that probably gave me a little bit of an advantage. Like, I remember at Greylock in 2012, one of the reasons I met so many great founders in fintech, whether it was like Ken at Credit Karma or like Brian at Coinbase or all these folks, was because actually VCs at the time had no practice for it, right? There were consumer VCs, but they mostly were chasing social media and Web 2.0 and then mobile. And you had enterprise VCs who were mostly doing the go-to-market, right? How you're going to sell to the global 2000, get that contract size up, all these other things. There were these holes though, right? Small business, payments, what we now think of as fintech. And so that actually was exciting for me, because I always believe that it's just a matter of time in software, that software isn't a sector. Software is an enabling technology to let us solve problems for any sector, any problem. Mm. And so anyway, Joff, that for me, that was part of the journey. So Daffy, for me, is actually that same thing. Wow, in fintech, we've now had our Web 1.0 generation of fintech. And so I wrote this post a few years ago, which actually Daffy partially came out of, where I said, what's the Web 2.0 equivalent for fintech? What's fintech 2.0? And I did the same thing. There were things in Web 1.0 that worked and things that didn't work. And in Web 2.0, we solve for the things that didn't work. I feel that same way in fintech. And so Daffy is a little bit of that product of what I think of is this next wave. We spent a lot of time in Web 1.0 just bringing things online. We just took offline thing and brought the software. We took a software app and moved it to the web. Yeah. Web 2.0, we actually built more new, uniquely, authentically unique products. Like Monster was very much moving the offline process of recruiting and job searches online. LinkedIn was saying, wait, if you built a professional network where people own their reputation relationships, that could be a platform to solve that problem 10x better. And so I feel like in fintech, we just went through a wave where basically people were just taking products that already existed and moving them online. And Daffy for me is a little bit more of the, you know, let's rethink how giving works, right? Like the donor advised fund, that's a great financial product, but most people have never heard of it. And the business model is broken. And so it only gets sold as an attach rate product to the wealthy. What if we built a product that was actually for the 60 million households in the US who give to charity every year and care about giving? This is not just something they're doing financially. It's something more meaningful in their lives. It's meaningful to their family. It's meaningful to how they want to live. Can we start tackling those type of problems and build something novel? And so Daffy for me was a little bit like, hey, we did all these great features around spending and saving and investing, helping people with these problems. Why don't we try it with giving? It's half a trillion a year in the US alone. Yeah. It's a pretty big problem. 2% of GDP.
I'm curious, you talked a lot about just brick fintech being new sector. As someone who's obviously built in this, cares deeply about it, maybe related to AI, maybe not. Like, where do you think it? I'm curious if you have any interesting takes about where you think some of this fintech innovation is headed, because I think right now there's a lot of fintech is dead talking going around like everything else. Do you have any spicy takes on fintech generally? And where do you think these, we're still lacking the like native experiences around financial things?
Yeah, I don't know how spicy this is, please, but I'll do my best. No, I do think, listen, like everything, I do think that in every generation, we solve some problems, but then we realize that we didn't solve some others. I do see that this last generation of fintech, and once again, I'm a very, not just a founder in the space, et cetera, active investor. So I do get pitched a lot of fintech companies because I'm still investing, which it turns out not everyone is, as everyone chases AI and a bunch of other things. When I try to think back of what we got wrong, some of it I will just say I've written about and some I haven't. Some stuff I haven't written about, I have to say, is, you know, one of the things when I meet with founders in fintech is I found that they're a little different than the typical software-based founders just trying to solve a problem. And that's just because of the problem space and who cares about it and who sees the opportunities to build something new. You get a lot of founders from the technology space who say, wow, all the technology here is terrible. All these apps are terrible. All these sites are terrible. Why can't we make it better? And they're right, but they rarely ask the question, why is it that way? Getting to our earlier question about process, market fit, it's like the reason Vanguard's website and applications are not great. There's a couple reasons, but the fundamental reason is that actually isn't critical path for their success.
Yeah.
Their go to market, their business
strategy. Set it and forget it is their whole business.
Not just that, but it's also who their customer base is, what's rewarded. It's just, and by the way, I do think they have an issue where like their culture lives to drive down costs and they still perceive software and IT as a cost. So they underinvest there. So I see these technical founders who don't really understand the financial piece of it or the economic piece, the strategy piece. And then you get people more of the finance business orientation who say, yeah, we could make money here. But does it really create value for their customers? Does it really economically leave people better off, both as a system and the individual? And so when I talk to fintech founders, I think some places where we went astray is it just became a little bit, you can make money doing a debit card. Everyone does a debit card. Someone has this aha moment. It's funny, as a venture investor, you do see this earlier than most founders or most engineers tend to see it. What happens is you meet a founder, and you see a company starting to work, and they've had this amazing insight. I remember the first company I saw, it was actually at Greylock in like 2012. The first company I saw where they said, actually, you can keep about 1% of spend. So actually, the way we're going to make money is if we get people to use this debit card, that actually scales really well. And 1%, you can build a business off that. And then what happened is within 5 years, all of a sudden, everyone knew how this worked and you had 1,000 companies.
And then you have debit cards, et cetera. Creator platform companies built in the whole thing. Yeah.
Which, by the way, I invested in a few of those because it's true. This is so I think we underestimate business model innovation. Yeah. So my spicy take is that in fintech, I think we got a little bit too much. You know, there's that old Howard Marks chart, which is it conventional wisdom or contrarian? And are you wrong right. or are you right?
Yeah.
And these outlier outcomes in venture are all contrarian and right, which is very hard. And I think that one of the problems that happens in fintech in particular is you get a lot of just conventional wisdom flowing through. So companies, they're right. There is a market. There is a product. You can make money there. But because it's conventional wisdom and because there aren't a lot of network right. effects or other moats to protect it, your reward for building out the product and feature is more and more competition and difficulty scaling to kind of those outcomes. Now, it's funny. I wrote about this. This is one of my epiphanies was like most of the products that fintech built in the 1.0 wave, from my point of view, were single player games. Right. And that's a nature of most financial products. But the early web was like that too. One of the big innovations in Web 2.0 is we put more thought authentically into what applications and ecosystems and environments are fundamentally multiplayer, not grafted on, not an invite or referral, but actually the product gets better the more people who right. use it. It's a product that you want to use with other people. Joff, you asked earlier, one of the reasons I'm excited about Daffy, giving is actually one of the financial activities that people do that is fundamentally multiplayer right. in most aspects.
That's right.
Right. Yeah. People care about who else they see them. You're at a school, you're funding the school, a church or a synagogue, a community center. There's a community around it. People volunteer, they give. It's not just a right. financial transaction. It's something more. But yeah, you know, so when I meet with founders, I do ask these two things. On the distribution side, for you, no surprise, I need to understand what yeah. the play is, like how they're going to get distribution. But actually, I find that the bigger flaw I find with most fintech founders is they haven't thought through the really, where's the value right. they're
not just
creating.
Value capture, basically. Yeah.
Not that, because I'm old fashioned. I believe that to build a sustainable, growing venture scale business, you are going to create value for your customers. And you can probably capture through revenue 10 to 15% of that value you create. It's amazing how yeah. humans are consistent about that.
Unless you're Apple, you can take 30. No, I'm no. just kidding.
Yeah, a little bit. Apple, my alma mater is that sort of thing. I think Apple, by the way, in talking about what game you're playing and how to keep score, I will say that at the end of the day, it was very formative for me. I was there when Steve came back, and speech I wrote about it when he passed away. But one of the things with Apple is the clarity it took them in when Steve came back to say, we're not playing a right. game for market share, right? That actually they cared about profits. Right. They cared about that. It may sound crass and it may sound like every business, and that's why don't all businesses focus on profit, that sort of thing. But really the clarity was we're not measuring ourselves by market share. That's actually not the goal. And the PC industry for basically its entire first couple decades was just obsessed with market share.
Exactly.
And I remember Steve saying, I was at the meeting, one of the things he said, this was the famous meeting where Michael Dell had given an interview. And Steve put him up on the wall, giant, like the giant room in Infinite Loop. It was like a two-story screen. It was like giant screen. It was like Michael Dell's face. And Steve basically gets up and says, Michael Dell was asked what he would do if he was running Apple Computer. And Michael Dell, because remember how Michael Dell, obviously incredibly talented leader, visionary, et cetera, but he could not have been hotter in the late 90s. And what did Michael Dell say? He said, some problems you can't fix. Like, you have to think about liquidating the company and returning cash to shareholders. And so Steve is like, Michael Dell thinks that every day you all wake up, come here, kiss your families goodbye, get in the car, go to Infinite Loop, and you destroy value. That our shareholders would be better off if you just stopped doing that, went home. And he was like, you know what?
Yeah.
He's right. Because if we keep building generic beige boxes, the world doesn't need another company that does that. Compaq does a great job of that. Dell does a great job of that. They don't need another company that makes boring beige boxes. And then he said, what market share does BMW have? Some questions when Steve asks them, you're actually not supposed to answer.
Just FYI. Most questions.
I learned that the hard way too.
You're not supposed to answer.
Yeah. But he said, no one. It's 1.5%. But you know why you don't know that number? Yeah. Because no one cares. Because all you know is that either you're in one, or you're watching one when it's driving by. Like there are products that people lust after. And he was very big, like Apple exists to make products that people lust after. And whether you think that was the right framing or not, I reflected back at eBay when they were doing their turnaround, because I was there for that, and how they lacked that clarity, right? They wanted market share and they wanted to be a fun, colorful experience of discovery and delight. And I was like, yeah, those two things, like you can't be Toyota market share and delightful, surprising innovator. That doesn't actually work. And so I don't know. I think that clarity is very important.
So I'm curious, as you think about in that fintech piece, like the value capture versus value creation relationship, is the problem that without value creation, that like it all gets competed out, like it's just hedge funds trading against each other? Or is it that those businesses can't actually grow? Because it's value capture works for a while.
Listen, it definitely does. And if we looked at fashion or food or that sort of thing, we would probably could come up with examples where actually that value capture has been going on for a very long time, and it's not clear it's going to end. So I think, though, it's because coming from the startup world, especially venture-backed ecosystem, you're fundamentally building disruptive companies. I think the assumption that I have is it's actually all of the above and more, right? That the reason value creation helps build these businesses, because remember, you're trying to build a business that's going to scale rapidly. The whole idea is that you're going to pay this money up front to build out this technology, this platform, this business. And the business is going to have may have large fixed costs, but the variable costs are really low. And so as you scale, they become incredibly profitable and scalable businesses. That's the venture model. And if you're not creating value for your customers, it hits you all over the place. It's not just competition. Anyone could do it, because that's not always true. There really is something to brand and distribution lock in. But I think that there's always the danger that people figure it out. Usually it comes out in churn, right? Like you have a product that's not good for people, you start losing those customers. Like they figure it out. And at some point you run out of people who are willing to try it out because they've heard that this doesn't work or it's not good. I think it does leave you vulnerable, because if you're based on irrational kind of acquisition or desire, you're kind of faddish, right? The emotion, it's like anything else that's emotional. There's a curve where people fall in love with it. Everyone's doing it. You see this with fitness equipment all the time. And it's whether more recent with Peloton or all these other things. Like when I look at the fitness space, does it really work? What is the goal? Or is this just the next thing that people fall in love with? They do for a while. But then you fall victim to this churn and the next thing. And so for me, I think it's just because there are certain games I'm good at playing and some games I'm not good at playing. There are people who are brilliant marketers, brand builders, people in Hollywood with creative stories. There are businesses you can build around that irrational attachment of effectively commodity products. Like I'm watching science-backed Peter Pham and others like Liquid Death. That founder came out. They're selling water
in cans.
Man, but they're doing a good job of it. And actually some of the fundamental insights to it really played out, I think, phenomenally. But that's just not the type of business that I know how to build. And as an investor and as an operator, I've always been at the point of view that like the best investors, the best operators, they know what they know, but they also know what they don't know, right? You have to have some hubris that you can come up with new things in your area of expertise, but you have to have some humility that you don't know everything about everything. And there's certain games you're not suited for. Actually, getting back to video games, like I know there's certain types of video game I'm just not great at. I'm not a Twitch guy. Like I'm never going to do 200 moves per second in anything. That's not what I'm built to do in more ways than one. But when it's strategy, when it's playing out like a little bit more of like, how do you put things in motion so that once that happens, like you have a real advantage, sustainable advantage, that tends to be my type of game. And I feel like for me in products and services, particularly in fintech, I think that the products that create real value are getting rewarded, right? I think there's a reason why, like through this forest fire going through, right, we're seeing something, startups fall down, some bigger companies, unicorns stumble. I think you're going to see in fintech that the ones that really make it are the ones that actually deliver real value for people, not just at an individual level, but at a systemic level. Like it's actually better in the system that this entity exists, this product exists, that this offering exists. So I look at all my companies that I am a part of and the people I invest in, I have to answer both those questions for me. Does this make sense at the individual level? And does it make sense at the system level? And unfortunately, I think a lot of fintech products miss on one of those two fronts.
I think this is the question John wanted to ask, but what are some examples of fintech companies that are past the early stage, but the ones from that wave that you think do have meaningful value?
Well, I want to separate. This is my own personal journey too. If you look at my background, it's like you're an engineer, you're obsessed with problems like how can I get this to run in 30 milliseconds, like optimizing that sort of thing. And then you realize, whoa, if this runs in 30 milliseconds, but the humans using it take 20 minutes to figure it out, like you may not have solved for the bigger problem. And so you get into design, great product. And then all of a sudden you realize, okay, if I do good design and good engineering work, I can build a great product. But if it's not wrapped in a great business, you never get to do the 2.0 and the 3.0, right? And that sort of thing. And so there's layers to the problem. I think in fintech right now, I think there's actually a lot of great products that are going to stand the test of time. Personal finance and financial products in general, money is very much a trust business. And so the incumbents have a real advantage in terms of not just distribution the way we think about it in software, like they have customers coming in, but actually just in that people are more risk averse. Right. There's more friction in them trying something new with their money. And by the way, it's a time of life thing. Yeah. The older you get, the weirdly more risk averse you get about financial products and services.
We saw this with startup banking just the year ago, right? With that, like, even if you'd worked with First Republic or SVB for years and years, when the shit hit the fan, you went to JP Morgan. Yeah, I get it.
I think so, although a lot of it went to Brex and Mercury too and that sort of thing. But no, I agree with you. There's a tough thing there. I've actually always felt that what was going on in fintech and personal finance, I am a consumer guy and I do like markets. When I was at Wealthfront, I talked a lot about the generational issue, and that was for good reason. It turns out that young people in personal finance have two big things going for them. One is they're just starting out, and so they haven't made those allegiances yet. So their willingness to try something new, play with new brands, different expectations about what products should do, or even their financial problems. I remember at Wealthfront talking about, like, the average financial advisor is in their 50s and their average client is in their 50s. And so it wasn't surprising that there was a lot to do there. But part of it was that they were willing to try new things. And the second problem was, of course, Clay Christensen, they weren't the best customer of the incumbents. So the incumbents weren't actually focused on making that great. So I do think that you have some companies that obviously made it to scale. Obviously, Coinbase is huge. Square is huge. There's so many companies out there, I think, that already got to escape velocity. I think you have a lot of unicorns that are adding real value that have scale. Obviously, I'm biased for the companies I'm involved with. I think Wealthfront has the scale. I think Acorns has a scale. I think there's Chime has scale. I think there's a lot of companies that have some scale. But I think that the reason I thought it was generational, though, is I felt like I'd seen this movie before. And so I would talk a lot about the fact the last time we had this big wave of new brands and institutions getting built in finance, it was as the baby boomers came of age. And that was a big enough generation. Schwab wasn't always huge. Schwab is a startup that started in the 70s out in San Francisco, not New York. This crazy idea that young people could place trades on the phone. And they basically built out a business that catered to younger people who wanted to trade a new way. And then they, in the 80s and 90s, they grew into, as that generation grew older, they did everything for them. But by the way, there was a lot of churn. People forget. Schwab almost didn't make it. I forget whether it was 81 or 82. They were actually acquired by Bank of America for something like $60 million. And then they were respun out four or five years later into this big independent company. And so I think we're going to see that same churn. This is the thing that I think this is the thing that fintech founders, you asked about what fintech founders may not have gotten wrong or we as an industry didn't really internalize. Because very few folks on the technology side really study financial history or understand the markets or all these things, the cycles in finance are longer. But anyone who works in finance at any level understands the different cycles in the markets, right? Bull markets, if you're tied to the stock market, right? Markets go up, markets go down, right? If you're tied to macro, you have recessions, you have growth periods, currencies have ups and downs. Like, there's all a trade. There's all these economic dependencies that the financial world studies. And by the way, if you work at a public company, your finance team very much knows part of that investor relations, part of managing that whole world, even strategy is what macro environment you're operating in. By the way, Apple does this incredibly well. One of Tim Cook's gifts running that organization is people underestimate running a global company at that scale of manufacturing, macroeconomics, the way they adjust to the fact that, oh, the currency's weak over here, and actually this is what's going on in the consumer market there, is something that you only have to deal with, like, physical products, like, more than software. But I think in fintech, you had a lot of startups that just assumed that they was like a software business, kind of goes up and to the right and exponential. And so I think they had adjusted to the fact that multiples for cyclical businesses are fundamentally different, right? They tend to be lower. And then second, they didn't adjust really well to what products and services, how are you going to adjust to the inevitable obvious thing? Interest rates will go up. What do you do? I think one of the reasons, by the way, that Wealthfront was ahead of the curve is they knew this eternally. We had a lot of sophistication early on about what companies did and wealthy folks. And it might have seemed interesting or strange that Wealthfront rolled out its cash product in, like, 2018, I think it is, 2017, 2018. But it turns out, like, when rates go up, actually a cash product is a great product to have. And it turns out that environment tends to correlate with recessions or economic uncertainty. The stock market tends to be not as good. Modern financial institutions have a portfolio of products that deal with that cyclicality. And this is the problem that startups have, is that usually in the beginning, you're a one product company. And even if you had a second or a third, if you don't get to escape velocity in time, you're going to end up being acquired. You'll end up being a piece of someone else's puzzle. And so I think we're going to see a lot of products live on, but I think you're going to see fewer companies really be the aggregators, although some have reached escape velocity. Like I said, like you now have companies that have not just millions of customers, they have tens of millions, right? They have more customers than many of the incumbents. And what that means is that they have time, assuming their business model is solid, to build out that portfolio of products and services. And I actually think that at some point we'll see them become acquirers as well, pulling more and more products and services. My biggest concern in fintech is that generationally, that gift is not going to keep giving, right? We don't have another army of young consumers in 10 years to adopt financial products and services. And so I think we're probably within 5 years of seeing a lot more consolidation in that space, which means that innovation will have to push to other markets and other edges to get.
I think this insight is really interesting that, you know, a lot like if you're a B2B company, you probably should focus early on acquiring small companies or startups. The downside of a really low churn business is it's really hard to convince someone to switch. And finance is clearly a low churn business. If you have a relationship with Fidelity, you probably aren't moving it because it's going to cost you a bunch of taxes, maybe, and it's all just parked there. So starting on these generational trends is super important, I think is a really good insight that like fintech needs to be focused on new customers that are new to that market, even if the market is well established. But the second insight, especially in the US, it's real upstream here. There isn't a boom. There aren't a whole bunch of young people coming like there were with brand new needs. It's super interesting.
I think young people can be one source of a new market. But I'm really, listen, Clay Christensen, who passed away, was a wonderful, wonderful man and a real thought leader. But I was very influenced in the early days by the innovator's dilemma and the fundamental insight that actually the big companies are not stupid and slow. They're actually filled with smart, talented people who have access to a lot of distribution and a lot of resources. But what they do is the reason they keep getting disrupted is because they focus on their best customers. And that best customer measure is very economic. So I would actually argue that there's always more customers that are not prioritized by the existing incumbents than ones who are. And actually technology adoption, going back to Geoffrey Moore, the early adopters, that early majority, the late majority, et cetera, that always exists across all these platforms and spaces. And the combination of the two, I think, always means that there are markets of customers who are basically, Clay would have said overserved, but I think of it as underserved, but they're not prioritized, right? Like I said, for this first fintech wave, it was young people, because any young person who walked into a bank or brokerage, et cetera, knew from the minute they walked in that they weren't the focus of that institution, that they did not care about them. They were not a great customer. They were not prioritized. The products weren't for them. But I will tell you, I see that same thing all over the place. Ironically, I think you're seeing that shift, right? The generations move on. Every decade, I don't like generational language so much. I prefer to think in decades, right? The 30-somethings have now become 40-somethings, and they tend to have 40-something problems. And guess what? Their 40-something problems are different than the problems that 40-somethings had 30 years ago. And by the way, their point of view on what they trust. I was at one dinner that JP Morgan actually hosted. Jamie Dimon was there, et cetera. And I remember him talking a bit. We had a good debate discussion about brand and what role technology played in brand, and that there was a new generation coming through, not just young people, but actually everyone who came up in the last 40 or 50 years that actually based some of their trust in a brand on their digital experience, right? Like when you go to a financial institution, you see a janky website. For a certain generation of people that are getting older and having more money, you don't feel like trusting that institution with your money quite as much, right? It's not just a convenience thing. It's not like ease of use or any of the other things. You're actually like, wow, like it's 2024. If you haven't figured out how to build an app by now or a website, maybe you're never going to figure it out. And I'm actually worried that what else you can't build? What's going on in your back end? Are you secure? Am I going to loot? Like, how are you? And that's not fair because they might be prioritizing other things, but so I still see, I think that there's a whole world of financial products and services that basically a very small population have access to that can be opened up and democratized. GAFI, once again, the Donor Advised Fund, 60 million households in the U.S. give to charity. I think only 2 yeah. million donor advised fund accounts exist right now. I don't know what the right penetration is for that 60 yeah. million households, but it's a lot bigger than a single digit percentage. Yeah. And so I think there's a lot of opportunity there. And I also think that down markets like this, these forest fires that go through the startup community when all the VCs don't want to fund different things, they shift their focus and companies can't raise, they go out. Those always, it is like a forest fire in a way, right? There's now more room for new things to grow. They're not competing quite as much. And I think that what happens to the incumbents in these times, they start sharpening the pencil. They're less willing to make futuristic investments that might pay off in 10 years. And so in a weird way, they become more focused on the economics of their best customers, and they lay the groundwork for the next wave of founders to go, wait, we could do that much better now than we could 10 years ago. We could do that 10 times better. And there's a lot of people who need that solution.
I feel like the incumbents have all read Christian Clayton's. And it's because when we entered into the industry there, I felt like it was far more of falling asleep at the wheel and you could drive a truck through it. And now I can't tell if it's like this consolidation of power amongst the Magnificent Seven and they have this distribution and stuff, but the AI wave comes about and it's like Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Apple, we'll see. No one's falling asleep at the wheel the way that you would have expected back in the 90s, early 2000s.
I'd say this is true in fintech too. I'm a Fidelity customer and their website's pretty good. A decade ago, it was the worst thing in the world and they get it, right? Mm. Which is super interesting to see big companies figure this out.
By the way, Fidelity uniquely in their culture is actually known for the big giants in that space, probably being the most proactive in investing in technology, right? Like even in crypto, they acquired a company years ago. Like they actually pushed that envelope more than most. They're just a private company, kind of family run. And so they don't get quite the visibility that Schwab gets that sort of thing. But no, one thing, I'll not to argue Joff too much, but the insight that Clay had in the innovator's dilemma, it wasn't that the big guys are slow or that they asleep at the wheel or that sort of thing. It was actually, they are very smart. They have a lot of resources, but they use that and they focus on their best customers, right? The customers where they deliver the most value and capturing most of that value for the business. And so actually in some ways, I agree with you, Joff, 100%.
Yeah.
When I talk about Geoffrey Moore crossing the chasm, when I talk about Clay Christian's Innovator's Dilemma, the number of people I run into who haven't read and all they've heard are a podcast interview. They haven't read the book. They just talked about it. They read a blog post. They saw some tweets, a meme or two. But I don't know, like that fundamental insight, I think that repeats. And like I said, for incumbents, you have to know who you're competing with and who their best customer is. Like building Daffy would be far more anxiety. I probably wouldn't have done it if I didn't feel like I understood. I know exactly how the big companies think, who their best customers are, what they're focused on strategically, like what they're looking for to do next.
Yeah.
You have to assume, I think you have to assume always, whether you're competing with startups or incumbents or both, it's so dangerous to assume that they're not as smart as you, that they're not as fast as you, that they don't have the insight. By the way, it's a reflection of that product question I asked before, what game you're playing and how you keep score. That's how you orient your team. I want to know that about every company. I want to know what game Fidelity thinks they're playing and how they keep score. I want to know what Vanguard thinks. I want to know what Schwab thinks. I think whatever market you're in, you have to know what your competitors think, because what you really want, what really gives you room to run, is when you say, if they're really smart and if they're ambitious and they go after the biggest opportunity that they have in their framework, they're going to go this way while you're going that way.
I think that's great advice, honestly.
Yeah.
Trying to race them just straight out, it's just, you can get away with it with some industries because sometimes it is really sleepy.
Yeah.
But usually when you peel the onion, you discover there's a reason for it. In my space, I can tell you, donor advised funds, the reason there's not a lot of investment there and there hasn't been a lot of innovation and features is because one, the business model only rewards larger accounts. Like they're all based on percentages of assets under management. And who has enough money to put hundreds of thousands of dollars aside for charity? Right. Yeah. Not that many people. So it's going to be a niche product. And by the way, in their view, they're looking for the next $1 trillion.
Yeah.
Donor advised funds are measured right now. It's like $250 billion. That seems big to us. But like in the industry where like these giants are accruing literally trillions, going on tens of trillions of dollars, their big push has been their advisory platform, international. This is where they're getting the next trillion. So for them, the opportunity just doesn't look big enough for them to invest against. But it turns out that's one of the advantages. You're building a new company as you start, you can think differently. I change the customer base, change the business model. We'll see if it works. It's a startup. We have a few more miracles to pull off before we get to escape velocity. But I think that Clay's learning, I wish more people understood it. By the way, some of the companies we talked about, you can see it's in their DNA. Like Netflix knows. That's why they keep making the turns. I do think the big giants do it, but I don't think it's just the seven. Actually, I love that we have so many giants now. I'm a contrarian when it comes to competition, that sort of thing. My biggest fear growing up in the industry in the 80s and 90s was it felt like it was consolidating all the Microsoft. I get very worried about one giant, right? Controlling things or two. You get a plurality of giants. I'm like, they're all going to fight with each other like that.
You don't want the monarchy is at the deal. I get it.
Listen, the truth is one of the big gifts that LinkedIn got, I will still say to this day, I was very paranoid about a few things. I'm Andy Grove, only the paranoid survive kind of thing. I was very paranoid in the early days. I knew LinkedIn was a network effects business. I knew that if we got it to scale in that moat, someone with an existing network can reappropriate their network and actually basically speed run to a network effect if they do it the right way. They usually don't, but they could. And so I was worried about Google, man. And you gave me 15 years. Joff, you talked to me 2007, 2008.
Yeah.
I'm looking at LinkedIn's traffic and going, how much traffic do we get from public profile pages on Google? Their mission is to organize the world's information.
I was like,
as soon as they figure out that part of the world's information is understanding who all the people are, I was like, they're going to get to it. And then what happens? Oh, thank goodness, Facebook. Oh, thank you, Mark. And you just scared Google so much. That they did Google Plus, and Google Plus could have been oriented towards LinkedIn, but it was oriented towards what they thought the Facebook competition was.
The whole 7 years I was at LinkedIn, I had that same thing going through my head. I was like, the largest latent professional network lives inside of things like Microsoft Outlook and Google, and it's just unactivated. Who you email has created my network for me. I've got on average like 10,000 people that I've emailed over the history of my mailbox. All the connections are there. I'm like, man, they're going to wake up. They're going to somehow flip the bid on that. And I'm not going to have to go through the manual process of connecting with people. I'm going to have an instant out of the box. Here's what your professional network looks like. Now let's go ahead and build it for a variety of reasons that never really transpired.
Email is such a good example of the thing you're talking about, Adam, right? Which is Google dumb? Is that why they don't build like a really slick interface for like really busy people to manage their email, like a superhuman or an inbox or all these things? Like, are they just bad at building product? No, it's that Gmail has, I don't know how many users, but I assume it's many hundreds of millions. And most people don't have that problem. And so it doesn't make sense for them to focus on this narrow slice of people who want to spend $30 a month for high-end email organization. It's just, it's not that they're bad. It's that if you were a PM at that company properly asking the question, what game do we play and how do we keep score? Those things are way below the line, right? And I think that's the same goes for Microsoft Outlook and the professional network opportunity. They're playing the game of helping enterprises manage their email securely. And it looks scary to you at LinkedIn because in your game, it's the most important thing they would do. But in their game, it's nowhere near the list of things, which is why being paranoid is good. But also, you have to be paranoid imagining you're them, not imagining you're you wondering how you'd get killed, which I think is interesting.
That's exactly right. And that's why I said, I actually like it for not... When you're early days founders, it turns out there's so many problems you have to solve to build a new product and a new company. Competition is usually the wrong thing to focus on like day one, day two. But I do think strategically, like if you look at the seed memos that, you know, I've written or some of the strategy docs that I write internally, I can't get away from it. I think it's very important. You have to understand the main competitors, right? Strategic challenges. What is their motivation? What game are they playing? How do they keep score, right? What do they think they're doing is the most important thing. Now, you do get some advantages also to our earlier conversation. Large companies also develop politics. And you talked about process product fit and that sort of thing. Google, for better or for worse, one of the things they optimized early for good reason is they had some silos, right? The Gmail team very separate from the search team, very separate from this other team. And so anytime you get innovation or products or services that kind of blend across, you're generating fighting. By the way, this happens in government too. Like, part of the disaster we've seen around crypto and regulation in the US has been really a bunch of different regulatory agencies almost debating who has sway over this important new thing. And some of that, is it a commodity? That means the CFTC is in charge. Is it security? Then the SEC is in charge. Wait, this looks like money. Maybe FDIC is in charge and the Treasury. Like there's all these different things. But that's another part of understanding the landscape, understanding how big companies think about it. So if you're looking to disrupt incumbents, for me, if you don't have a clear idea of who that underserved market is, who is that market of people, and can it support a new business, a new product, the scale you have to get to build a company around it. And then second, why aren't they going after it again? Why are they optimizing that way? What game they're playing? But yeah, going back to LinkedIn days, you think about the assets any big company has with 2020 hindsight. Joff, you probably have so much PTSD from Yahoo, right?
And Yeah, man.
I had the same feeling about eBay. So many things we were close to circling, we just didn't get to. But when I look back at the reason, it's almost always organization and prod, like how you, but it's the strategy, how you frame the problem. And this is the thing the industry does. You keep getting these innovations that change the rules of the game. Like we talk about AI, but like a smart person, very smart, three sigma IQ above average, come out, whatever education they have, but they're brilliant, they're smart. You take that person 5 years ago and give them a customer problem, etc., how to build a skill set, they're going to come up with a different answer than that person today, given where AI is, in a whole bunch of fields, a whole bunch of products and services. And so that's the gift that keeps on giving, right? And because that company and that product that was built in 2018 can't shift to the new technology and the new architecture that easily. And so I do think that there's always new opportunity, but you have to know what you're competing with. And by the way, it even applies to brand a little bit. This is why brands struggle. You build these great brands, traditional industries. Mm-hmm. Inevitably, they always have to be refreshed or they suffer and fail, right? If you look at the ones that have stood the test of time, they've gone through these up cycles and down cycles. You know, if you look at Coke and Pepsi, you have this whole thing.
There's just that Yahoo scar tissue. I was just thinking about that. It's, man, at the height of the dot-com bubble, if you look at the stock price at Yahoo to the point in which it sold to Verizon for about $4 billion, in between there was the destruction of $102 billion worth of market cap and or something in that magnitude. And you're like, holy crap. And, you know, I was senior enough when I was there as a vice president that you have to hold yourself accountable and culpable for like a bunch of those failures. And they never really go away. Listening to you talk, Adam, the other thing that so many of my friends who I really admire, they're real students of history. Like a lot of what you were sharing, like the Geoffrey Moore, the Crossing the Chasm, and Clay Christensen, and these other things, you're a real student of history. It's really clear to me. Why do you think that is? Why do you think so many of these folks are going back in the past to understand the future?
I think this gets back to, like I said, I've always been fascinated with how people come together with more rational things like technology or money or that sort of thing. And the people side, there's a lot to learn. Of course, from history, because at some level, you're building organizations, teams, platforms, are their ecosystems and societies. Like these all have the idea that history doesn't repeat, but it sure does rhyme a lot. Or if you don't study history, you're doomed to repeat it. These truths have been gone for a long time. And I find, like Reed and a number of others, part of it is just if you're getting into anything, you want to become a student of it, right? People have been building technology businesses for a long time. And by the way, it's not just computer-oriented technology. There are other things to learn from how railroads got built out or steel or agriculture. There's all these innovations and the economics. And we do learn new things as a society. I talk about this in my personal finance class, right? How investing works, et cetera. The problem is a lot of those cycles are so long, you end up with generational problems. The gift of technology is really that one, mostly what matters is more recent on the technology front. So it's okay if you don't exactly know how an operating system had to get built in the 80s, because you can be up to date with how it's getting built now. But it's better if you know the full history on the technology side, and because some of the problems are evergreen in computing. Same thing with building companies and organizations. Some of my inspiration, you talked earlier about Reed. Reed talks about different founding moments.
Yeah.
But I remember having wonderful discussions with him at one point. I always loved Greek mythology. I think that all these systems of mythology and legend, et cetera, encapsulate a lot of fundamental truths about the human experience and the dilemmas we run into, et cetera. And Greek mythology can be dark at times. Maybe Norse is a little bit more dark. But anyway, it's darker up there, less sun sometimes. But like in Greek mythology, you see this pattern. where there's a golden age, where there's balance in nature, the gods walk the earth, right? There's a lot of magic in the world. And then the gods kind of retreat, but they act through demigods, right? They create still magical beings who have powers, etc. That's a Bronze Age kind of thing. And then there's an Iron Age where there's no magic in the world. It's just humanity dealing with it. And you say, it's funny, but I always saw this parallel in the technology world. And I remember talking to Reed about it. He had the same thing about multiple founding moments, which is part of the power of founders is that there's this golden age. The founders are doing everything and they're together. The team is small. They break through. But one of the advantages that founders rarely take is they have this power to actually anoint people or give people the moral authority to lead.
Yeah. Right?
I'm not a founder at LinkedIn. I was not even there the first few years. But Reed always imbued me with a lot of agency and moral authority to make decisions and run. He did that for a number of people. He talked about Jeff. He talks about a lot as a new CEO. Why do so many tech companies fail bringing in new CEOs? They don't do a good job of that. And then I think, unfortunately, I felt like I used to joke at eBay that I felt like I went through 2 years of the Bronze Age and then 2 years of the Iron Age in the turnaround, where one by one, all the original people who had that moral authority to know what eBay was about and how they got there and do things phased out. And I know you saw this at Yahoo too, and then you get more professional management in.
Yeah.
But I do think that there's a lot to learn, not just from history, but all these bodies of information, because we're talking about leadership. We're talking about competition. We're talking about economics. Yeah. These are not new things.
Yeah.
And frankly, even our written record probably doesn't capture all the things that have gone on, but I get insight from it. The same way that good product leaders, they play with other products in other spaces. You never know what insights it'll give you. To this day, like I talk to my team and sometimes I'm still talking about mobile games, what Supercell is doing or Niantic is doing and that sort of thing. Sometimes I'm talking about what's going on in the enterprise space. Sometimes I'll talk about physical products and brands. I still talk about Costco. Amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Costco, amazing.
Costco is a Costco. Well, Walmart, too. Like thinking about like the cross-dock shipping and some of the early work that they did around just like infrastructure to move that much inventory around. There's a ton of early innovation there.
That's right. And by the way, people forget Amazon wouldn't be as great a company as it is today if they hadn't had to go head-to-head and think about what makes Walmart great.
Yeah.
What is the what are things that they had to borrow and get great at to be actually great at that scale? And what were they doing differently?
Yeah.
And that they
I think they even borrowed their CIO at one point, which was helpful.
I love talent moving around. I'm a big fan. I don't want to go too far into politics, but I do think one of the reasons our industry works the way it does is that free movement of people means that when problems get solved, there's a window of time before everyone figures out and that knowledge goes. Like some of what happened with Uber and Lyft and all these kind of local build out businesses to me is a product of the fact that van almost worked and the people who were involved with it, it didn't work and it blew up. Those people went to the eBays and Yahoos and Amazons that worked and you met other people and slowly the information got circulated and people knew that actually Webvan actually did get to profitability or they thought sustainability in a market or two. They just overexpanded and then when the capital got pulled out, they couldn't unwind fast enough. That led to the fact that eventually I have a big belief if something really works in this industry, as long as the people move around and don't get locked into some corporation somewhere, that knowledge gets out and then there's always new energy and people will in and take a swing again and say, this time is different. We'll make it work this time. Yeah. Despite all the negativity in the last couple of years of the markets, for me, actually, it's very exciting. I have no doubt that we're all going to be talking about amazing companies and services in 5 years that are worth incredible amounts of money, have incredible scope and customers, changed everything. And it turns out they will have been started in this pandemic era.
Thanks for listening. That wraps our conversation with Adam Nash. Next week, I'll be back again with Joff, and we'll be talking to Kip Bodnar, CMO at HubSpot.